Okay, Ramblers, let's get rambling.
Now where it is now, everybody wants a piece of the market.
Oh my God, that is funny!
I don't remember asking you a thing.
I'm funny how? I mean funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you?
With all due respect, what the are you talking about?
Oh, I'm sorry, did I break your concentration?
What the so funny about me? Tell me what's funny.
You represent the idiocy of today.
I did not know that.
English, motherfucker, do you speak it?
Are you listening to me?
How's my shit together?
Nice personality combination, hostile and intolerant.
So that's it then. No one else really knows anything.
Well, everyone, thanks, Dr. Jackson. I'm Tom Al. Matt Byrne on the board. Greg Pappas in studio. S&P futures down 43. NASDAQ futures down 183. After this is the longest winning streak in 20 years, we're cutting back a little bit here today. Got oil prices down kind of a chunk, which Greg will talk to. We were down. I had them down a buck something earlier, where I thought we were well under 57, but they've come back a little bit. They're only down 89 cents. 57.40. What would you say was a low last night? I don't know, like down $2, Greg. I had them in the 56 or someplace.
The low was 55.30.
Wow, so $2 lower than this.
Yeah.
Buy the dip, they say. Of course, if you bought the dip on the oil down, how many times you'd be getting clobbered, right? Because every dip was another.
It's been ugly for a month and a half now.
Yeah. OPEC is saying they're going to put another 400,000 barrels a day into the system, eh?
Yeah, that's a punishment. Kazakhstan and Iraq are supposedly non-compliant with what they want, and they've been overproducing what they said they were gonna, and the other countries said, here we go. And the market got wind of that and immediately started trying to sell ahead of them.
Well, I was in grad school when this OPEC first started, right? We're talking about a long time ago. And I remember Dr. Milton Friedman saying, when everybody was, gloom and doom on the cartel in OPEC, which, was pretty bad, he said, you don't ever have to be worried about them holding their numbers because they'll never be able to enforce the cheating amongst each other. No matter what, there's going to be slippage, and he was right about that. I mean, they all cheated a little bit. It was obviously worse than before they became together as a cartel, but there always has been cheating. The biggest discipline is among each other.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Saudi probably was, I'm going to say, the most compliant, maybe. I mean, I don't know. But some of the other guys have never been all that compliant, I don't think, have they?
What they ended up saying was, we're going to do another 411,000 barrels per day, and that spooked the market. Saudi was the one who were saying, you guys better shape up, and then they
keep pumping.
Didn't, and they failed, or... What Saudi says is Iraq and Kazakhstan and a couple others failed. And so they unwound their voluntary cuts to production.
Well, they're not real big fans of Iraq anyway.
Right. And they had initially, I think it was OPEC wanted to cut on purpose for 2.2 million barrels. And then they did that and the price kind of stabilized. And then Iraq and Kazakhstan were over producing.
Is Kazakhstan? Are they? They're not Russia anymore, but they're more an ally than say Ukraine, who they're fighting with, right? Kazakhstan's sort of.
I think
tight
that
with
was
Putin.
More of a national policy decision in order to keep their whatever spending, more paid for. It's a domestic decision, but that was the buzz, and then I think this was the confirmation. So maybe, buy the rumor, sell the news. Is that what?
Well, you want to be a buyer? No, it's buy the rumor, sell the news. So, that's what it used to be. Anyway.
Yeah, so now we were selling the rumor, and now I think we should be probably buying the news, at least short term.
Well, when we talk about break evens on oil, again, this is a somewhat of a weirdo example of cost accounting versus full-in accounting. I mean, here when we talk about oil being $67 a barrel, I think, Greg, of course, the thing of it is, it's so complicated. Every well is different. Every area is different. I think with all the new technology, you can still make some money fracking at 57. I don't know below 50 if you can, or 45, but I think at 57 we're probably not going to see.
I mean, it depends on where it comes from how far you have to ship it.
That's exactly right. There's places that are probably going to shut down. Right now, it looks like we're still pretty much at the top of our game in terms of production here. But I think they're smacking right into the jaws of somewhat of a world recession. I mean, China can't be using as much as they were.
Well, China, as one of the largest consumers of natural resources, you know, they're not complaining. When food and energy goes down, you know, they're what we call, you know, hands in. So they're buying a lot in terms of food from South America and us, and energy from wherever, whether it be Russia or Iran, or you know, they're happy to see the commodity prices go down because they're such big consumers.
Well, I don't know if you watch this that much because you watch different stuff over the futures thing than I do. My sister-in-law was telling me how she listened to some podcasts, and of course she wants to see if the guy wants to come on the show. Evidently, he's a former Marine, merchant Marine, something, something. And he became an expert on worldwide ocean traffic. And he does a podcast every day regarding shipping and the ports and stuff. And,
oh, I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, but he evidently, and this is her paraphrasing of the show, is that none of the stuff at Long Beach and those places has fallen off yet with all the tariffs and everything. But the ships leaving China in the last week have dropped way down. So the guys at the port in Long Beach, you wouldn't notice any problem, but the guys on the water coming this way, evidently there's a big drop down. So he's anticipating numbers the next week or two to seriously drop. Is that what you guys are hearing?
Definitely. And I think, let me find out real quick, because I know I had a couple things up on the blog about the shipping. Is she talking about Sal Mercogliano?
Yeah, that sounds like it.
Yeah. Yeah, we put one up on the blog. I can put it up in the show notes, too. It's called What the Ship, and he's a maritime historian at Campbell. So just discussing China and the traffic coming out of the boat numbers from China to here, being down more than 20%. So,
so what do you do with all those ships? Just park them? It's not park them. Yeah. Talking about a landlubber term.
Dock them. Dock them.
Book them. No, that was book them, Dano. Dock them.
Dock them. Was that Hawaii 5-0 reference?
No, that was Dragnet.
Dragnet.
Oh, no, okay. Hawaii 5-0, you're at book them, Dano.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking about a piece of trivia. You know, Tom Selleck's first big TV show was the hell was he on? He was on
Magnum P.I.?
Magnum P.I., yeah. And really kind of the whole reason for that show, the budget for that show, was Hawaii 5-0 was such a big star show. It been on, you know, it was on a while. They had a huge area in Hawaii just set aside for filming that show.
Nice.
And
it's got to be a good assignment.
That show went off the air, they basically looked for another show to use the spot, and then they settled on Magnum PI.
So it was the dream the dream cast.
Well, then they just said, "Well, we got to use this stuff," and that's how Magnum PI came in. It was never like we thought this was going to be the world's greatest show. They did it. They used it because they had to find a use for this big, essentially, production facility that they had for Hawaii 5-0. What the hell is the guy's name?
That would be
Jack Lord.
Real nice assignment. Go to Hawaii, record the show.
Cool. Jack Lord, right? Was the
cool
original
cool cars? I don't know.
I think that sounds like a job for Matt Weber. I think it was Jack Lord was the dude.
All right.
And it was a good show. But it looks
like he was Jack Lord, Steve McGarrett.
Steve McGarrett, yeah, the original Steve McGarrett, the father of the guy on the newer show, right?
That's right. Yeah.
And anyway, it was pretty good. You know, some of those old shows, some of the history of them are pretty amazing. We're going to talk about when Jan Flanagan gets on. I saw something on YouTube and sent it out to everybody, and we'll send it out by the end of the show. The guy's conclusions were that the Smoot-Hawley tariffs are one of the reasons why we ended up with Adolf Hitler. Whether or not you go with the guy's conclusions, I think they were participatory a little bit.
It's a cool video.
But the history the history of how it made its way through Congress and the promises, and how when the promises you give people when you're running for office, maybe there's issues with today's world or not. The promises you give people when you run to office and you do stuff just because you said you were going to do it, even though the world has changed, how that somehow or another can be very damaging. Is that a fair assessment, Greg?
Something about the butterfly effect.
Yeah.
There's a lot of interconnected stuff, and if you shake the box, you never really know what's coming. In terms of correlation and causation, who knows, but it definitely exposes weakness in certain things. So when there's additional costs, and costs that are especially going to hurt certain geographical or groups that are already hurting, there's a potential for fireworks.
Why do you think that even,
of course,
I'll make the
other side to that would be maybe they were weak already, maybe it was already on the way to happening and you just needed a straw that whatever but broke the camel's back. But what you can guarantee is as soon as the weaker are exposed, things are going to change.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. We've been on the show now for quite a while, obviously, and before this, John and I were on The Score. One of my themes all along, after living through, and actually, I'll say participating, I was part of the how one firm dealt with the inflation issues in the 70s and 80s. When we started going through this routine, really starting in 2000, maybe even earlier, where prices went over, where people's incomes did not match inflation. And it started probably in the mid-80s, but really didn't get crazed till 2000. But and you started, the massive shift in society where all of a sudden I'm not talking about women going back to work and being a sexist thing. All of a sudden, a family almost needed two wage earners to survive. Now that came along with all the ancillary expenses of a second car, somebody take care of the kids, whatever it all is, after school care, whatever it comes down to. It was a monumental shift in society. And you ended up, whether it was good, bad, who knows, but it certainly was different. Because wages never kept up with either the wealth of the country or really the prices. And or even to that extent early on, and we talk about being somewhat clairvoyant once in my life, Greg, because of my experience with the inflation stuff, I said if we ever get inflation, given the fact that people's incomes have not kept up with the prices they are now, you're going to essentially eviscerate 60% of your population. Could I have been more correct?
I think that's not only shown, but also you get the surprise factor in that we really were selling, if you will, a different story to the public.
Yep.
While implementing stuff like, I'd say, NAFTA and other things that, in general, reduced costs and reduced prices, but they also reduced
correct
broad strokes of labor here. And when that happens and you're actively promoting something that is not apparent and you can't see, yeah, you can buy things for cheaper, but the other part that we didn't really tell people was, oh, by the way, you might not be getting paid anymore. So your costs went down 20%, maybe more, but your income went down 80%, or it at least got hit.
Your real income.
It got hit, A, because not only you lost your job for a while, but B, you know, it was inflated. Your new salary was really inflated a lot through whatever. And that having that surprise, again, people can tolerate a lot, but when things start to be surprises, or meaning different from what they can see, that tolerance goes away. And that's when big shifts happen, either in the market or in the polling stations or in the voting booths, or that's when you get the larger moves.
Well, the thing that nobody anticipated, and I don't know what, I'm not an expert on it. I would tell you what, I would love to, you know, a couple of guys on the show, I might even include you in this, actually are capable of some pretty good research. If we could stop the world for 3-4 weeks, I would love to get, can you imagine the guys on the show were not stop arguing enough for us to do some good work? I think we probably could. I'd love to find out exactly what the nuts and bolts are of how this going, you know, overseas for production, how it went wrong in some ways, because I think that when we have here, this is, I'm not going to go through a whole lesson on.
Well, that's why we got AI, Chief.
Yeah, right. We're not going to go, I don't think AI, even after all these years, I don't think AI could describe, you know, wage economics and stuff as well as I can, given a blackboard. Anyway, but that's another story, and there's people that are a hell of a lot better than me. But the idea would be, we never expected, I mean, nobody ever expected people in China or Mexico to make as much money as the people here on the assembly line, or whatever you want to call it. But that's okay, as long as it's free, in terms of, in other words, somebody's working in, say, Chicago, for instance, and he or she is working in a factory where you got all kinds of power, you got great access to water, you got all those things going for you, transportation, you can get to work cheaper than any place else, you know, back when people rode the L and stuff. The people here are always going to make a little more than somebody else because you have what they call comparative advantage. Your people are going to be more efficient because they can get to work easier. They have all the power behind them, so if you got a powerful machine versus somebody else using a wind up drill, you're going to be more efficient. You're going to make more. So there's some degree to that. But everybody now is so easy to say the Milton Friedmans of the world were absolute idiots and this never had a chance of working. That's total BS. But if you were to told
Uncle, it's a question of who it worked for. And there's no, I don't know if there's a question of if it worked or not though.
Well, the idea was that if you brought stuff overseas, you brought factories to Mexico, those people, even though they started out at $3 an hour, in 10 years, instead of making $20 an hour like we are here, they'd probably be up to 10 or 11, in which case they might be able to actually buy a car. That you were developing customers, you're developing world trade. But Milton Friedman never anticipated that in China you were going to have your political hack and the firms here were going to pay off the politicians to keep their finger on the neck of the guys in the plant. Nobody anticipated that 50 years later the guys are still making all the rice they can eat and you're paying off politicians to get the job done. That was never part of any economic program.
I mean, that's the difference between a practitioner and an academic.
But they never thought that
the only people who really predicted stuff like that were
nobody predicted.
Call it like nobody Montesquieu, predicted. Rousseau.
Well, and the idea
Adam
is
Smith.
The rest of the world doesn't act politically like we do. You would have thought that in 40 years somehow labor would have overcome the politician getting the graft driver on the nice car, and it never has. Nobody. You would have not been hopeful. But you would have, well, now, you know, a cynic, like maybe, you know, some people, I won't say you are.
No, definitely a cynic.
Would look back on it and say, why would they ever think it would ever work out that way? Because it worked out that way here.
It did work out. It worked out great. I mean,
well, it worked out fine. If people dying in line, you know, striking people and stuff. I mean, it wasn't easy to get there.
Well, regardless of the implementation of cheap labor, it worked out for the rest of the world and for us, especially in terms of productivity that went through the roof, and also costs in terms of not only the raw materials but also the outputs themselves. I don't know how much an iPhone would cost if it was...
Well, that's my point. Not near as much as you think, because we still have all the other advantages. We've got the power. We've got, like Bill Moriarty was on last week saying, they can throw the consultants out of China all they want, but good luck finishing the dam. I mean, we have expertise here. But my point is, Vietnam was always going to be the place where maybe you sew the blue jeans. Okay, but it shouldn't be that much different. I mean, at some point, the people in Vietnam should be able to buy stuff here. There's always going to be a difference. Like I'm saying, there's always a comparative advantage someplace. But nobody anticipated, you know, the idea that, I mean, how many years of the last three decades more millionaires were formed in China than in a country in the world?
Oh, 100%.
Because, but why? You know,
and that's why I say the economics works. It's just when you introduce the human factor into, it's just an extension of, you know, behavioral tendencies. When you say that we're going to have all these phones manufactured or all these whatever blue jeans manufactured, question of where do we do it, the transportation costs, we're somewhat efficient, so it's not the end of the world if we send it to different countries. But in terms of what happens, whether it's $5 saved or $1,000 saved, you know, the laws are still the same. The tendencies are still the same. It's just
I don't think anybody anticipated the power of a multinational corporation and the immorality.
Dwight Eisenhower?
He probably did.
He told us to our face. You know what, I think the UChicago guys kind of
actually, you know what? If you dig back into the archives, I actually wrote a column on Ike's speech way back in the day. Beware the military-industrial... what's it called?
The military complex.
I actually wrote a column on that where I was not real complimentary to Ike. Did you ever go to these things? I used to go to these things once in a while. And old, how can I use this term politely? Old fossil face codgers, when they leave their job, they say beware of what the stuff they were supposed to be taking care of when they had the job. Now, if anybody knew the military-industrial complex coming together and could have done something about it, it was Ike. The guy knew everything about that, for God's sake. The only guy who knew more about it was probably George Marshall. So from 52 to 60, the dude played golf. And when he leaves, beware the stuff I was supposed to be watching out for the last 8 years. I mean, thanks, Ike.
Yeah, well, maybe.
You know who else
but also nobody's complaining about all the... all the money that was made on the way
out. Well, I'm saying the same thing happened here with, who was the guy? Was it Donaldson? No, was it Arthur Levitt. He came from Donaldson, Lufkin, and Jenrette, a.k.a. Pershing. And he was an SEC chairman for a while. He was Duke Chapman's roommate in law school or something. I got a quick story for you. I went to, I was in Vegas doing some seminars for CBOE. And there was this, I don't know, some. It was a risk management conference. It was out in the...
Wait, did you say Pershing was an investment bank?
No, Pershing was a big... they had a huge operation on the floor. They were big...
I thought DLJ was an investment bank.
Well, they were that, and plus they were a massive clearing agent for people. They were Pershing was one of the biggest traders on the floor. They must have had 20 brokers. They had a broker in every crowd. Maybe had 50 brokers. 40. And... I stood next to the Pershing brokers in the OEX for 20 years. And
Am I missing something? I thought DLJ was like they were acquired.
They bought Pershing or they did somebody.
Credit Suisse or something.
They disappeared someplace. But
yeah.
But Arthur Levitt was big shot in there. And when he got the job as the SEC chair, I think he was able to sell his stock for no taxes or something. There's a tax dodge in these guys that get appointed to cabinet level positions.
Yep.
A cabinet level position does not mean a cabinet position. There's other positions out there that are considered cabinet level, and I think SEC chairman's one of them. Anyhow, we're supposed to go out there. There's a big, what's the place, it was the original Fat Farm, but also has a great golf course. They have a tournament there every year.
You call your friend Doug.
Was it La Costa or one of those places? Anyway, so they get me a limousine, and I'm thinking, they didn't just get me a limousine. That never happened before. But sure enough, the limousine was for Arthur Levitt, and I was going to be a passenger. I'm sitting there going, wait a minute. I get an hour's ride with the, well, boy, he's probably not going to appreciate this, the questions I'm going to ask him anyway. So I sat there for like an hour, and finally the driver goes, he's not coming, and we took off. It was just me. You should have seen this thing. The big, like, sofa thing in the limousine with the bar and all that stuff back there, and I'm sitting there. This is where you're supposed to have, like, five ladies or something.
Oh, I looked up.
They're sitting there by myself.
I looked up Donaldson, and Donaldson was Skull and Bones Yale. So does that mean he was with H.W. Bush?
Probably. Yeah, probably.
He was younger than H.W.
No, the other. The younger Bush and Kerry were both...
Skull and Bones.
Yeah. One of my mother's great lines, she goes, they were running, boy, I don't know what she would have thought of the last election. When he ran against Kerry, she goes, how is it out of 330 million people, we got two guys running with C averages that lay naked in a coffin looking up at dead animals running for president? Isn't that the...
Makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Makes goes, sense
she,
to me.
She I goes, can't remember. We get anybody else?
It's God. A very important qualification for leadership.
Yeah, but anyway, his big spiel when he gave, I listened to his address. It was at the Economic Club of Chicago or someplace. And he did the same crap. When he left, he starts talking about all the bad stuff he had to watch out for. He didn't do crap when he was in there.
Or maybe he did do crap and we just don't know about it.
Whatever. Well, I'll tell you what, the military industrial complex was way bigger when Eisenhower left than when, and he was, how many guys play golf so much and of course they got the tree named after him?
A tree?
Yeah, was it the Eisenhower tree down at Augusta or Congressional or someplace?
Huh.
He used to hit the tree off the first tee all time. It was known as the Eisenhower tree.
I'm not saying
S&P futures out 43, Nasdaq futures out 187. Be right back, Mr. John Flanagan.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Hi, this is Audrey Johnson at Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. Sellers, if you're wondering if it's the right time to sell your home, call me and I will be happy to provide you with a free market analysis and a personalized sales program for your property. I will help you get the right information to maximize your returns in this economy. Buyers, it is the time to look for the home of your dreams. What you couldn't afford 2 years ago is available now. Don't get caught in the rent price spiral that's sure to come. Plus, if you buy or sell a home from me at Home Source Realty, you will get a free 40-inch flat screen TV at your closing. Call me at 708-349-3456 or email me at audreyjohnson@realtor.com for more information and details on this offer.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now.
Come on, flounder. Can't spend your whole life worried about your mistakes. You f***ed up. You trusted us.
Same thing that happened to Matt Byrne. He trusted us. He bleeped up. What can I tell you? SP Futures down 46. You trusted Andrew.
Yeah.
By the way, when you guys go to like the New York and stuff, who's the leader on like the subway and stuff? I can't imagine.
Oh, you guys fight over leadership.
There's not a natural that guy who actually like reads the map and everybody just follows him or something.
I tried reading the map. He just tries to go by instinct.
Oh god.
He's no salmon.
SP Futures down 46. The SP Futures down 198. Dow Futures down 265. Again, we've been up like almost every single day for a while. Well, I mean, what's the streak been? 8 days, Greg, or something? Individual stocks, the Dow Caterpillar is down 366. Goldman Sachs down 290. JP Morgan down 193. Microsoft down 248. It's been up every day. Salesforce down 311. So, you know, we're down a little bit, but not a whole lot. Europe, the DAX is actually up 130. European markets mixed. I don't know about that necessarily. The FTSE's up 99, 1.1. CAC's down 50.6. Looks to me like it's more up than mixed. I don't know where that description came from. Nikkei up 378. They traded, did not trade since last Thursday. Hang Seng, they have not traded either. What's going on over there, Greg? Why are these guys on another holiday? Shanghai, again, they have not traded since April 30th. So anyway, nothing going there. On Friday, Dow was up 564. S&P's up 82, NASDAQ down up 266. So today we're, like I say, it's about half of that, a little more than half in the S&P's down and maybe two-thirds of it down in the NASDAQ. I don't know if that's a Fibonacci replacement or whatever that is. Bonds, 10 years down 2 basis points, 4.29. We've been right around 4.30 for a while. The Bund down 1 basis points, 2.50. We've got oil. This is kind of the big news today, although it was down over $2 last night, 2.5, and now it's only down 75 cents. 57.54, Brent down 69 cents, 60.60, natural gas up a dime to 3.73, RBOB down a penny to $2. It got up to 209. Greg has been trading some of this crack spread. He's going to explain a little bit after we're done. Gold up $79, 33.22, so it's heading up on dollar weakness. Silver up 41 cents. We got a lot of that stuff for people, but I don't really have anything above the market, so I wish I did, so I'm not all that happy about it, because we should have more. Never can be long enough on the way up, can you, Greg? Foreign exchange, here's the number. British pound is up almost a half a base point, 113.40. I'm sorry, the euro. I don't think that's the high, but it's getting close. British pound, 133, so dollar's dropping. Crypto down 1,600, but still 93,938. Boy, Matt, a lot of stuff there. What do you got for us, traffic, weather, sports? Sox helped out by the big guy upstairs.
It seems like that, yeah. It's currently 6:39 a.m. on May 5th, 2025. As far as traffic, inbound on the Kennedy from O'Hare to the JB interchange is currently at 40 minutes, outbound at 31. Inbound on the Dan Ryan from 95th to the Jane Bird interchange is at 22 minutes, outbound at 11. Weather in Chicago, 47 degrees at Midway and 48 at O'Hare, high of around 59 today, mostly sunny and breezy. Tonight, partly cloudy and a low of 47. Down in Phoenix, it's currently 439, 61 degrees right now, partly cloudy and a high of 69 degrees today. In the MLB yesterday, Cubs played against Brewers and lost 4-0. This marks their 14th loss this season compared to their 21 wins. Cubs, though, back at Wrigley Field tonight against the Giants. The game starts at 6:40
p.m. What's the weather prognosis on that, Swami?
It's looking like we will be having mostly cloudy, hopefully no rain tonight.
It's going to be cold, though.
Going to be a chilly one, low of 48 tonight. White Sox, though, won against the Astros, 5-4. Sox not faring well with only 10 wins this season and 24 losses. Tonight they're in Kansas against the Royals at 6:40 p.m. Briefly, the NBA, yesterday's semifinals were going on. Pacers took down Cavaliers, 121-112, and Warriors defeated Rockets. Final score was 103-89. Tonight, Knicks at Celtics at 6 p.m. and Nuggets at Thunder at 8:30 p.m. That's all I got, Chief. Back to you.
Greg, Nuggets got any chance against the Thunder? I'm saying no.
No. I don't know if you saw also the 2027 NFL draft was announced. They're thinking they're going to do it in the National Mall.
This is where we pick steers? No, this is where we pick people.
I mean, that'll be pretty cool. They do it in
what is
D.C.
Your buddy Karl Marx was wrong, you know.
Karl Marx was wrong?
Yeah.
What was he wrong about?
He said religion was the opiate of the people. I think it's football or sports.
Football is religion. I don't see the difference.
Well, there you go. It's just like gladiators were, you know, type of thing. Jack Flanagan's old enough to have been a gladiator fan.
Zing.
Oh, sorry, John. Is he here? Is he with us? Oh, jeez.
I'm here.
How are you? By the way, how are the...
Okay. Yeah, not telling any tales out of school.
So what do you used to drink at those events? Wine or beer?
I don't know.
I'm just saying. Like,
hot chocolate.
Yeah, I don't know if they had chocolate back in Roman times, but you never know. Hey, two quick stories. I don't want to get like Charles Corralt, or the other guy. Who was the guy who died? Who was on 60 Minutes? Andy Rooney.
Oh, Tim Russert.
No, Andy Rooney. I don't want to turn into Andy Rooney. But my interesting weekend. My nephew's. You know, what is she? My godniece or something. My nephew's daughter had her first communion on Saturday at the same place that I had mine eons ago. Boy, talk about memories. But just as a little bit of a period piece of how the world was sort of different, the Catholic churches were the absolute mecca of communities, and at least on the south side of Chicago, but not everywhere, and really in a lot of north side neighborhoods as well. I mean, it was people were attached to their church. There was Father's Club, Mother's Clubs. I mean, people's lives were... They had a credit union, they had everything. And in those days, John, the church is half the size it was now. And there were masses every hour on Sunday, and you had to be like skinny and lickety-split to when people were coming out to shoot your ass in and get a seat, otherwise you were standing. So everybody said, all right, we got to double the size of this place. And can you imagine people doing this today? People went from house to house to the parishioners and asked you to pledge. I don't think anybody knows what that term means. But you would say, yeah, I'm good for, over the next 2 years, I'm good for $300, say. So it was every 2 months you plunked whatever, you know, $10 in the... there was a big box in the vestibule for people's pledge checks or cash or whatever. And they took, I think, they must have taken the big stack of those pledges of people because I think you signed a contract. And went to the bank and got a loan and built the thing.
Yeah.
And they ended up with, you know, the priest they had at the time was Mr. Save Money, right? He was, you know, and well, school had, this is the church was a, the parish was a square mile. And half of it, well, not half of it, but what do you say, 20% of it was a golf course, the Reach Country Club? And still there were four classes in every grade of over 40 kids in a class. So say 160 to 175 kids per grade. So when we had our first communion, there was like 165 kids, and the place was half the size. It was jammed. And, you know, they just got out of there as, you know, as quick as you possibly could, which wasn't very quick. But now Saturday, Greg, I was so impressed. Every one of the kids, there was 80 kids, essentially did the whole service. I've never seen anything like it. They put five kids up there in front of microphones, and everything you read, and all the scriptures and all the stuff, all the kids read it. Somebody'd have like two lines, and the next kid, the next kid, the next kid. And it really didn't take that long. They were so well practiced, did such a good job. I don't think you could have done it with 160 kids. They had 80. And matter of fact, my nephew's daughter was up one of the... She was, what, pray for your mother and father and stuff? She did that line, and she was okay. But this is so funny. A couple of the guys... You know, all the kids are nervous, except for like a couple guys. They're not nervous at all. They look like young Bill Clintons, and I'm going, uh-oh. I'm going, these kids are going to be politics. They loved it. they did their two lines, and they were pissed they were off the stage. Oh, my God. So then, you think things in episode, Audrey will be on later, but I'm going to tell a story before she's listening. We're driving along 95th Street, and it's packed, Greg. 95th Street is the major... you know, east-west thing, it's 1220. So we get in front of Oaklawn High School, and all of a sudden there's this big commotion. People have stopped their cars and so forth. Well, it turns out these two geese, somehow they're wandering along the street, and their three little gooselings are in the street and can't get up over the curb. But evidently another one had fallen in one of the grates. So traffic stopped. People are there making sure traffic stopped. So Audrey, of course, hey, pull in here, grabs her nice coat, says, you got to put a coat over them, that way you can lift them up. She goes there with the mother and father, like, nipping at her ass. Unfortunately, she didn't get nipped. She picks up the three gooselings and puts them under the fence so that the parents can fly up and over and the kids can get back into the street. Meanwhile, the coppers, I think, are pulling the fourth one out from the... And she was the hero. The big coat gathers them up, shoves her the thing. Odd's the best. I mean, she just loves animals to such a degree. And I hope... I don't know what they were doing winding around. They're so far from water. And the little ones couldn't fly, so that was a long walk from someplace. Yeah, I don't know where the hell the nearest water is from there.
It's very tenacious. It's amazing.
But British, of course, you know. Odd immediately, her nice, you know, Sunday go to meeting jacket, she immediately sacrificed it for the two geese, three little geese, and you know, it wasn't all that messed up. It wasn't wet or anything, but still, you know, Odd saved the day. So I don't know what that says.
God bless her, Audrey. That's great.
And I hope they made it back to wherever the hell they were going, and the police saved the other, but they were not going to leave without the fourth one. So I hope they found it. Him or her. I don't know where the hell. I still can't think where the clear nearest water is to there. And the little ones couldn't fly anyway. Talk about a day, huh, John? I mean, stuff just keeps happening. So what'd you do this weekend? Were you out and about and saw all kinds of crazy stuff?
Not really. I worked in the yard. You know, got the rain barrel installed, so we got water for Riparians, and did a lot of reading, catching up on mail and stuff. So yeah, very quiet. A good weekend for indoor work, pretty much.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the things on Monday we try and do with John and with Greg is trying to go into some of the history and more of the deep definitions of a lot of what we're talking about. And I spotted this thing on YouTube on last Thursday or Friday. It had to do with the Smoot-Hawley tariffs. And I'll send this over to Greg at some point here, and he can send it out. But, you know, the theme of it was that these things were one of the things that created essentially the situation that gave rise to Adolf Hitler. I don't know what kind of, you know, if the guy's trying to do some kind of corollaries or whatever. I don't know if I would agree with that. But you hear about these things, and you never really know how they happened. And I started listening at it, and all of a sudden this tape became just an education and I'm kind of careful what you promise, right, John? Because things change between the time you promise. I'll give you the real quick definition, and John probably knows more than me. But during the 20s, and I've talked about this, 100 times, everybody would say it's the Roaring 20s. Market was going up. The advancements in automobiles and aviation, really never a time like it. The innovation, trains, you name it. Everything was so much different in 1930 than it was in 1920. It's probably never been a decade like that in terms of advancement. You know, we started the decade with Model Ts, and we ended with cars that could go 100 miles an hour, right, John?
Yep.
And so all this stuff was happening at one level. At the other level, agriculture and all those other things, they had... expanded for World War One, and all of a sudden World War One's over, and the people over in Europe started, you know, their own grains again, and all of a sudden the farmer prices are going down, the stock prices are going up, and but what, 20% of the voting public was rural, and now it's what, 6 or 8% or something. So when, yeah. When Hoover ran, one of the things he ran, one of his platforms was that he was going to institute tariffs, sounds like today, to protect all these people. Well, of course, he gets in there in 1928, right? And all of a sudden, you know, they're hacking around with this for a while. He kind of backs off on it, but it was a Republican-controlled Senate and House. And which one was which, Jenner? Smoot-Hawley were the two guys. One was Speaker of the House, the other one was the head guy in the Senate, right?
Yeah, I'm trying to see.
I don't know which was which, but all these pictures of all these guys, let's just say people didn't age as well. Were those guys two of the most fossil-faced dudes you ever saw, or what? I mean,
they were not young then either.
No, and they made Simpson Bowles look like they were Olympic performers, right? So all of a sudden, these guys passed this thing. Meanwhile, the crash of 29 has happened. The country's going to the absolute dumper. And Hoover, who's a really bright guy, going, I don't know if I want to do this tariff thing now because a lot has changed. But, of course, he told everybody how this was going to be the solution to everything. Boy, it sounds familiar, doesn't it? And all of a sudden, he How long did he wait before he actually signed it, John? He just was such mixed emotions about signing it, so he signs the thing. All of a sudden, these tariffs come in, and the world was going in a dumper anyway, and all of a sudden, you know, the bank crisis and everything else, and all of a sudden, you know, you get these tariffs on top, and that would became increased taxes for people. It totally shut off some of the people in Europe, where now they were just starting to ship stuff overseas, and Germany's got these huge reparations of people, and now they can't pay them, and now they can't export stuff because of tariffs. And it just became an absolute bleep show, didn't it? I mean, tariffs being part. I mean, it was there anyway. I don't know that if there were no tariffs, it maybe would have ended up almost the same. It seemed to accentuate this thing, didn't it?
Yeah.
In terms of farming, I know that the farmers' prices and they were actually going down before. So the farmers
for the whole decade. Yeah,
the farmers were actually one of the ones pushing for a lot of tariffs.
And Hoover promised it to them during the campaign.
Yeah, wheat and dairy especially. So they were looking for some help.
And I think by the time it became there, it wasn't the help they wanted. I mean, times had changed so much. But all the pictures of these guys in these suits and all this stuff, it's really a period piece, would you say? John, where do you get all those pictures?
Oh, yeah, and I didn't realize, they were born during the Civil War, both of them.
So really?
They were the, It's not the avant-garde of the Young Turks of their time, that's for sure.
And they were both voted out of office like in the next two-term election, right?
Yeah.
They're
from Western states. So, Pauly was Oregon and Smoot was from Utah. He was a big official in the Church of Latter-day Saints too.
Why did that not surprise me?
Yeah, it's kind of those are sort of outlier states politically, because they were relatively new, even in the 1920s.
How did a guy from Oregon become Speaker of the House in the 20s?
I think he was Ways and Means Committee. Was he?
Okay, he was Ways and Means Committee. He wasn't Speaker. Okay, you're right. You're correct.
But they were, it shows that they're, those were the kind of, the agrarian forces, and they're kind of like, there were other progressives at the time who identified with farmers and, rural life.
Originally, it was about ags, and then maybe it was the Senate version that really expanded to industrial.
Yeah, it definitely expanded from the ags.
It started with ags.
And then it became how much? I guess how much industrial did we? The thing of it is, when you talk about that 4-year period, you really got to be careful and say, before October of 29, and then before the bank. I mean, to talk about every month was different, right, Jen?
Oh yeah, and the October 29 benchmark was just convenient because you got the headlines and the panic and the huge collapse in values. But that's just that's a marker. It isn't really useful much else. You can't really connect it to lots of other things. It was certainly building for a while, but it was not something that necessarily had to be inevitable at that time, I don't think.
Well, there was like a mini crash. I got my book right next to me. I'll dig it out maybe next Monday, Jen. I go through this. There was a bit of a mini crash, like almost like a trial run in March and April, where the market was in for a few days, Greg, or something, but went down pretty good. And then it was like everybody was really nervous on the New York floor. And J. Pierpont Morgan. He was still alive, right? And he was he was actually a member of the New York Stock Exchange. And he got on the floor himself, and the headlines were, J. Pierpont Morgan himself went down in the midst of the selling and went to some post and started buying. He started buying and turned the market around. Well, that was March and April, but nobody was able to do that in October, right? There was no savior.
No.
But J. Pierpont Morgan himself... Greg Pappas himself went into that oil pit and started buying oil. Did you see that, Greg?
Bingo.
Yeah. All of a sudden, oil turns. Would you do that last night? We were down to 55.5. Now we're up to 57.
Sometimes you got to step in.
So we're going to read in an hour. This guy Pappas, who the hell is he? He came in and bought like a million barrels of oil. Anyway, but somebody probably did last night, huh? I mean, somebody bought it down to 55.5.
Definitely.
So yeah,
might have been the government.
But the thing that I read about the tariff itself, Jan, and it's amazing how much you can learn if you don't mind listening a little bit. I never realized how it got to be until I listened to this tape, in terms of how it was promised kind of really long before any of this crap happened. And it kind of started along Starlight. And Hoover, I think, talk about, Hoover was probably one of the smartest people that was ever president. Wasn't like an international engineer and everything?
Oh, yeah, the relief efforts during World War One for the Belgians.
Yeah.
And, I mean, he was a precursor of Marshall in his, you know, ability to, you know, to understand the hugeness of a problem, you know, when it came to human suffering and rebuilding. So he was, you know, it very much in that mold of somebody who thought big and you know, not a stupid guy at all.
And I think what a lot of what Roosevelt did were really his ideas.
Roosevelt played fast and loose, too. I mean, he did pretty much everything possible, I think, even after he was elected, to embarrass Hoover and make it look like the New Deal was the, you know, the wave of the future, and to, in some ways, kind of worsen, you know, Hoover's ability to do anything to capitalize on that for his own gain when he was inaugurated.
Hoover appealed to the industrialists, which was a flat-ass mistake, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he essentially, he's almost like Trump appealing to the Bezoses of the world, right? Good luck with that. But, you know, these are lessons that people have learned before. Remember who was one of my favorites, Sarah Palin? She was being interviewed once and said that these oil companies, as much as she was a Republican, said you can't trust any of them. They'll tell you they're going to do this and that, and if you don't watch them like a hawk, they just don't do just what they want to do in terms of, you know, environmental stuff and everything. So you got to watch everybody. They're all crooks. That was from her. Those were her people.
Yep.
And anyway, so but the fascinating part was what all the stuff that changed between 1928 and then, well, you get in, the election would be in 28, and then you don't really, in those days, you didn't get sworn in until March, right?
Yeah, March 4th.
So he was in there, and all of a sudden, all this stuff happens. He had to be, by the time he signed that thing, he had to realize that it was a bad idea. He just had promised so many people he couldn't wiggle out of it, right?
Yeah. You know, there's other parallels, too, Tom, that, you know, the League of Nations was, you know, really hostile to the idea of tariffs, and that's one of the reasons I think Smoot-Hawley got passed, was in defiance of the League of Nations, to which the U.S. didn't belong anyway. And it's similar today with the globalist, you know, efforts against tariffs. And I found an interesting piece the other day in the Epic Times. I haven't passed it around yet, but I'll get it and pass it around. It's by Jeffrey Tucker, about sort of the background to the WTO and how the U.N. had pushed the same idea, you know, in its charter and through the late 40s and 50s for the ITO, the International Trade Organization. And, you know, there was, you know, great suspicion about it in this country then. And when they finally did pass the GATT, you know, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, that was a compromise to stop short of a full-blown WTO, you know, 50 years or so before it actually became a reality. And the dynamics today are very much the same, where, you know, the globalists, you know, see tariffs as, you know, destructive. You know, they don't want them, and, you know, they do everything they can to kind of trash them every chance they get. And you look at the treatment the U.S. has gotten in the WTO, you know, maybe it's a good idea to defy them every chance we get. But the dynamics are not that different from what they were in the 20s. So,
but we can't, you got to be careful taking a word from a guy who lobs the hundreds of millions of dollar numbers around and never once gives you a poster and says, here's how I figured that out. You know, I mean, it's also, John, it's much more complicated. And, you know, in those days, if you wanted to have tariffs, you know, well, when we were younger, if you wanted to have tariffs on a car from Europe, I won't say it was a good idea or a bad idea, but it was somewhat simple. The Volkswagen, Mercedes, and maybe the BMW, they were the third one. Well, what else was it? Did we have Audis, I guess, came over too. They were all made over there. Our stuff was all made here. And when the fully assembled Mercedes showed up at $50,000 and you had a 5% tariff, somebody paid $2,500. Not saying it was a good idea or a bad idea, but it was somewhat simple. But now that you've been somewhat open for a while, and parts and everything like that are going flying back and forth, and the Mercedes might be using the injectors made by Delphi or somebody, that it actually went from here to there. The complexity of it is, you know, when you start talking, and the people in the show are not, when you start talking to some simpletons, they think it's still simple, but it's not simple. I mean, it's a lot different to do it now than it did 50 years ago, because then at least you could say, here's something that was made in Sweden. Here, yeah, it was made in Sweden, sort of, but it's kind of assembled here, and the parts were here. I don't even know how you'd do it, John. It'd make a thing work any sort of sense right now, even if you thought it was a good idea.
Yeah, that's the price you pay for globalism, really.
Well, but is it a bad thing that a Mercedes are assembled here?
It's not necessarily a bad thing, but it makes it very hard to control production, or to, you know, when the system is out of whack, as it's certainly become.
Well, how do you think, why is it out of whack? So,
well, the fact that, you know, the way we're treated by our trading partners,
the only person who's ever said that is Trump, that how horribly we're treated, but without any backup whatsoever.
Well, that shows, I think, you know, how everybody's drunk the Kool-Aid.
Well, no, I'm, no. The intellectual property people have been complaining for a long time.
Well, other than China stealing stuff from everybody, I mean, I don't know exactly what the bitch is with Germany or Canada or anybody like that. I mean, the thing with China...
We can't sell our stuff, then. That's the problem.
We can't sell stuff in Canada?
Well, we can't sell cars to Germany, let's say, or France.
General Motors had... What were the car we built? Our cars, nobody wanted them over there, and didn't... What was the General Motors little car years ago? It was the biggest selling car in Europe, wasn't it? Was it an Opel?
It was a cooperative thing with GM. It wasn't like a
GM. Well, we've got Mercedes and BMWs are assembled here. No, I'm not saying it's perfect, John. I mean, I'm not about to say that, but the idea with Canada, I mean, I read that the average American buys $1,500 worth of crap from Canada, and the average Canadian buys $10,500 or $9,500 from us. How's that being screwed?
Well, I don't know about those numbers, Tom.
Well, okay. Nobody believes the numbers on the other side.
I don't know about them.
Well, how many more people in Canada go to
Disney? I don't think it's that much in favor of the U.S.
How many people in Canada go to Disney World every year versus how many people from here go to... Is there even a amusement park in Canada?
Well, who would know?
Yeah, who would know? I remember paying duties going to Canada in a canoe. Somehow I can't imagine you going on a canoe trip. Just saying.
Guys are both a little large to be in canoes.
I wasn't that large. And my brother is an ex.
Not talking about Wyatt. I'm talking.
Well, we was three of us in this canoe.
Look a little
big,
goofy.
Big, huge canoe.
Yeah.
My brother Dan, president of PTI, was an expert canoeist. He used to do 30-mile races on Sundays. We had to do portages and stuff on the Fox River. He had to jump out and then carry the thing around the dam and hop back in. He used to love doing that stuff. I was not that big of a canoeist. I don't think John would be either. You and I would have to put a little motor on ours and cheat.
You know, do canoe.
Yeah, we. Plus, I don't know how good you'd have been on the portages. Those things were a pain in the ass. On the Canadian side, it's called the Boundary Waters here, and on the other side, it's a Quetico Provincial Park, right? Well, you got to put on this side, Greg, and you can either get a boat to drive you up to the portage, the entrance into Canada. Well, you buy all this freeze-dried crap that tasted awful, right? And you go through, and the guy goes, okay, you got $40 worth of freeze-dried crap, that'll be like $2. And you gotta pay this old couple $2 to take your canoe into Canada. But there's no motors on the Canadian side at all. So literally, if you want a drink of water, you reach your hand over the side, and you take a drink. But I mean, on the U.S. side, you can't, because you can always see a little bit of... Remember when the motors, they were the two-stroke motors?
Gross.
We had to put the water... They don't do that anymore. And now the motors are all four-stroke. I don't know if everybody knows what that means. Two-stroke motor is, you actually add the water, the oil to the gasoline. So if ever you saw an old outboard motor go across the lake, there was always a tiny little oil slick behind it, right?
Yeah.
And some of it would evaporate, so it didn't totally wreck the lake. But the Canadian side, it was none of that. So you just basically put your canteen over the side, and that's where you got your water. But on the American side, you didn't really do that. Anywho, but it was fun. I can't say that I would do it again ever. But anyway, so John, what do you make of that? We had the big rally. We've got the guys in Saudi coming up today and saying they're going to put 400,000 more barrels. When did they do the first 400,000? Was it 2 months ago, Greg, or three?
They cut They cut production before.
But they nudged 400,000 up. Was it 12 weeks ago? And now they went the other 400,000, correct? Back to where this is their goal. Of OPEC has agreed to surge production by 411,000 barrels a day in June. Oil prices, biggest monthly loss since 2021. And I think this was these guys were... the decision comes a month after surprised the market. Yeah, it says the decision comes a month after OPEC Plus, that includes Russia and those guys. They did it in May, and they said they were going to do the second part in June, and people thought they weren't, but they were going to, evidently. We are, just for people that don't know, we are still doing 13.15, this is in February of 2025, 13.159 barrels per day. Just as a little bit of history of this, when Trump entered office the first time, what would he have been in? He was 2016. This is odd if you go back on this thing. This is a way of reference. This is an amazing, goes back to God knows what year. I'm not even going to go back all the way. I'm back to 1942. If you look at the difference in presidents here, Janet, I don't know what was going on at the time. It was long ago. Maybe your memory is better than mine. The only president I can see here, really, with a big drop, was George Bush. And he, when was he? He was, what years were he?
Obama. 2000 to 2009.
Okay, so in 2000, we were doing 5,700 barrels a day when he came in. And in 2009, we were down to 5,100. I'm not sure, what was that all about? It was before fracking, right? So it would be... Was it before that was all invented? Was it so?
Fracking's been around for a long time.
But I'm saying, if you really
started to take off after, I think, 2009.
Well, that's what I mean. But I'm saying, I guess my question is, how much of that can you pin on Bush or 9/11? And how much of it was Bush, or was it pricing? Was he so in bed with the Saudis he didn't want to do more here, or what?
Yeah, that's the first explanation I would hit on.
Really? So I didn't want to do that, trying to make it as political as I can. But Obama, comes in what, 2009, right? No, Clinton. Obama, 2009, right?
Yeah.
So yeah. Obama comes in 2009. He was 5.1 million, and he leaves.
Are you talking what? American barrels per day,
field production.
Yeah. I mean, are you even looking at the 70s, 70s, 80s?
Well,
we were really cranking.
Yeah, I'm saying is we were way down. I didn't want to go back that far. I was back to 1945. I didn't think I wanted to start there, so I started. But I'm saying in our recollection in the last however many years, the only person in office where they went down on was Bush. Because what, Clinton was 2000, he was about even. What years were he? He was
92 to 2000.
Or he came in 92. Actually, no. He came in. We were doing 7,300. When he left, we were down to 5,700. So those two guys, in 16 years, we did nothing but go down in production. How weird is that? And now since then, no matter who it is, Obama started at 5,700, and when he left, he was 9,200. Okay, so when Trump comes in, it's 9,200.
Yeah. Wait a second. Going down was the entirety of the 70s, 80s, and into almost 2000s.
Well, we topped out before, when you say that, in 1971, 9,600 barrels a day. It went down pretty much every year.
Yeah.
Till
that's right.
2000,
until 2003,
actually. And then we started.
It's even longer than 2003. It's probably, I think, 2008 or 2009.
2010 was the low point. 5,404. And from there, we went pretty much straight up every year.
Call it in the early and mid 70s. Mid 70s. If we were at 10,000, I mean, that's not a surprise. And then we didn't get back to 10,000 until, 2011?
Yeah. And when Trump got in...
Probably longer. Actually, maybe...
Well, 2017, when Trump got in, we were right about 9 million barrels a day. And he was pumping it a lot more until all of a sudden 2020 showed up and with COVID and it went flying down again.
And that wasn't really that bad.
No, it wasn't that bad. It went from, 8,800 to 10,000 and then kind of went slinking down again in 2021. But never below that. And then when Biden's been straight up pretty much the whole way. So the Trump-Biden 8 years has been massive increase in production. Is that a fair statement, Jen?
Yeah.
And I think it had more to do with pricing than anything else. I mean, I think that I've always said a million times that this industry is bigger than the presidency. But Greg, as a historical note, is absolutely correct. In the 70s, we topped out. We topped out?
I think it was 10,000.
Let me see.
Or close to it.
Yeah, we were 92, 91 in the 70s. There's a 96 and 71. Here you go. 1970. In November 1970, 10 million barrels a day.
And that was, I mean, we really didn't figure out fracking until I think the 50s, and then didn't really use it until the shale in Texas. And then once they found the shale oil in Texas, then...
Well, I thought we started in North Dakota, or wasn't it the...
North Dakota was, what, 07?
So from 1970 to 2006, our low point was 5,030,027 in March of 2006. That's really a long time to go straight down, isn't it?
It's
a long time.
Yeah.
I said it's 37 years. We did nothing but go down. Why do you suppose?
We were importing more. It's probably cheaper to import.
Well, it was $12 a barrel to import at those times, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So. And Saudi wanted to do that, and we had who else? Well, Iran was pumping out, Iraq. We had all those people.
And then around, I want to say 2004, they started saying, well, maybe we can do this hydraulic fracking. And all of a sudden, they said, well, how much can you do of it? And they said, well, how many wells you got? And it was off to the races from there. And I think what's Bakken is 2007 or 2008.
They're still pumping almost as much as they were at the top and the back.
And then after, you know, Permian, that, I mean, it was, we have enough oil and enough reserves considering the technology. If they even get more out of that, I mean, it's a lot.
Well, a lot of the shrinkage had to do with the Alaskan kept falling off, right?
Even if we don't use that for another however long, but just in Texas and North Dakota. I mean,
there was I don't know, John, I sent it out, I can't find it now, it was a long time ago. There was a picture when all this fracking started. They started figured out that you could do this like almost in every state to some extent. And when the prices were going up, there was a interactive map that was kind of purple as it was expanding, all the states that were going to have fracking in it. There was going to be a lot of it in Northeast Ohio. There was going to be a bunch in Southern Illinois, right? There were big fights over who was going to pay for the bridges, the counties or the cities, because they had to reinforce all the bridges to have these big you know, guys with all these heavy equipment to go over the bridges and stuff. And it was going to be in Northeast Ohio. And one of the listeners to the show from, God, a long time ago, her husband owned a hunting lodge with a bunch of other guys on some mountain in Pennsylvania that was surveyed to have oil in it. And they got, somebody bought the oil rights to the place. They had to put a road in there. It cost them $1.5 million. And they ended up, after 5 years, they never broke ground. So they left. And then another firm came in, I think, and they started drilling oil. And what they did, Greg, is they put the pipelines just were over other people's property down to wherever there was, they could put them in a trailer or a railroad car. So they put pipelines in, but they were on the ground. They were like a hose. You ever heard of that?
It's one way to do it.
And the idea is we're going to get X number of barrels out of this particular mountain, and then when we're done, we're going to essentially put the trees back where the road was, make it the way it was. And oh, by the way, we'll take our hose with us and we'll go home. And they've been making a bunch of dough, I guess, off the thing in the last few years, and I don't know when they're going to finish up. I haven't talked to her in ages, but they ended up getting their dough out of it, but it took, I think it was the second company. The first one, they had a 5-year deal on it. If they, we don't start doing something in 5 years, you guys keep the whatever they gave them, $250,000 for the rights or something.
Nice.
And I mean, if you ever driven through Pennsylvania, it's all this very, all this tree, these lower mounds that are all tree covered. It's not like the Rockies, and you wonder who owns all this crap. Well, evidently, individual people must own it, John, and have hunting lodges up there and do stuff. And it's weird. It's not like here at all. But
oh yeah, it's like the Johnstown flood. I mean, it was like a private club, you know, recreation.
But well, you know, this oil is a. It's an, all these industries are an amazing history when you trace what's going on with the product and the legislation and the different legislators. I mean, the more you look into this stuff, kind of the more you learn, right, John? I was stunned by that video, just by the different people. And by the time the guy Hoover signed it, he knew he was making a big mistake, I think, didn't you?
Yeah, the timing then was, you know, it was the wrong time, I think. But so much the tariffs themselves were a bad idea or should never have been enacted. But at the point at which, you know, this occurred in his administration, it was kind of like the last nail in the coffin.
Well, I mean, during his campaign, it probably sounded like a good idea.
Yeah.
We banter back and forth about this, you know, the economists right and wrong. Obviously, the thing with China has not worked out correctly. And there were, well, on some levels. If you're Kentucky Fried Chicken, it worked out fine, right? Or Coca-Cola, because all you do is sell stuff over there. But other than that kind of stuff, I'd say most people would say, it hasn't worked out the way we wanted it. The general level of economic goodness has not gone up that much in China. Some people made really a lot of the money. A lot of people here had to give money to people maybe they didn't want to. How could that have been done differently? I mean, I know I told a story before. My cousin was one of the first groups that went over there. They had mining machinery out of Columbus, Ohio. And the Chinese said to them, this is right after ping pong diplomacy, so this is years ago. They said, well, we'll buy one of all your machines, Greg. And these guys, my cousin goes, that's not happening. We're going home. They knew they were just going to take them apart and try and, you know, build them themselves. And they didn't sell them anything. How could, given the political differences, Jan, how could it have been done at all differently, or it just shouldn't have been done, or we're better off the way it happened than if it never happened? I don't know. How do you grade the whole mess? I mean, I mean, Carl's correct. It ended up being offloading child labor and pollution, which probably was never Milton Friedman's dream. When do you think Friedman would have said this isn't working? I mean, because the guy was pretty bright. I mean, if it wasn't working, he would have said so. When could we have smelled a rat, and what could we have done about it?
Well, I think had we been smarter early on, in, you know, at the time China opened up with Kissinger and Nixon, I think there's a lot of hubris in the U.S., you know, attitude towards China, that surely they could see the error of their ways. I don't think they understood the depth of the power that, you know, the Chinese Communist Party had, and they didn't really want to imagine, you know, the cruelties that it forced on its own people, which there's plenty of evidence in the 70s. What had gone on, the Cultural Revolution, you know, in the years since the 40s, when Mao came to power, there was a willingness to just look aside to that, pretend that that was just an aberration, that wasn't, you know, baked into the whole system. And then the idea that prosperity, the likes of which, you know, we felt we had in spades, that we could be a model to the Chinese, and surely they would be triggered by the same things that had triggered us, and they would understand the wisdom of doing business in a way that, you know, the U.S. had kind of mastered at that point, and thought that this was their biggest exportable product, you know, how to do things and how to build things and how to enjoy life, that the Chinese would immediately respond to that and become more like us. I mean, this is
that was the error.
Yeah,
I remember
at the time thinking, well, you know, this is one of the reasons this opening up of China didn't happen earlier than it did, was because of people like Nixon, who would, you know, demonize the Chinese, you know, as vice president for that. And I thought, well, this is ironic that now all of a sudden, you know, he's the one opening it up, when he's the one that made impossible to do this any sooner than when he became president. But in any event, you know, over the long haul, there was a mistaken idea that, you know, we could, you know, help the Chinese buy their way into a more favorable attitude towards capitalism, and, you know, they would abandon their Marxist beliefs when they saw how wonderful the system was, when they got a good taste of it. And of course, I mean, what could be, you know, a bigger failure, really? All it did was, you know, give the Chinese Communist Party total power.
And, well, what would you do against
international business practices? I mean, everybody began to kowtow to the Chinese in order to get their plants in there and to get that market opened up, whether it was Hollywood or automobiles or you name it. And so, you know, they eventually enslaved not just their own people, but the entire, you know, world market to some extent.
Well, if we plant your ass in the Oval Office, and I'll sentence you to Greg Pappas as your VP. And you're sitting in there one day, and all of a sudden Bill Gates walks in and he goes, "Hey, look at these bleeps over in China. They seem to have like 300 million computers, and guess what? They bought one thing of software from me. It looks to me like they're copying it." Duh. And you guys are sitting there going, "Well," and all of a sudden he leaves, and the guy from Pepsi comes in and goes, or Coca-Cola, "What are you talking about? I got 1.5 billion people drinking a Coke a day. Don't do anything. This is great." That's when you guys turn to each other and say, "I think we picked the wrong day to stop drinking." Right? I mean, it was so uneven. At one point, there were more pictures of the Kentucky Colonel guy over there than there were a mile, right? Right. And some people did amazingly well selling crap over there.
I remember there being any. I mean, there was like an emotional blowback against the Chinese in this country because of their one child policy, but I think even then it should have been pretty clear to demographers and people who, you know, thought far enough ahead to worry about these kinds of things that eventually this would mean they would not be the consumer giant that everybody thought they already had become, and they would decline rather than grow. And surely that's what's happened here. But, you know, that didn't deter anybody in this country from, you know, encouraging them to do whatever they wanted when it came to controlling their population, controlling ideas or thought. And
well, there's people here that were just selling stuff there. If you sell stuff, you don't care what they do.
Right. Well, and,
it's, you know, and, I mean, and we would, but most people don't.
Your silence is being bought, really. Yeah. You don't protest it. And that's become, you know, baked into our system now, too.
Well, we had a guest on early on in the show. I don't know if Kathy got him or Matt Weber. He was a guy that did Western Suburbs. He was either West Chicago or someplace out there, hence the name Western Suburbs. And he did coatings for pots and pans. Don't call him Teflon, or he'd be very insulted. And he said, "I'm very happy here. We have a plant here. Never want any part of China." And all of a sudden, the people that we do business with, the pots and pans that want the coatings are now being made in China, and people tell us that if we want to use your coatings, which we do, you better have a plant over here, because we're sure as hell not shipping the pots and pans all the way from China to your place to be coated and then shipped back around the rest of the world. So he says, "I have a place over there where we do coatings, a plant or two." And he goes, "I hate it. I don't like the area. I don't like the fact that we're paying people off, basically." He said, "What else am I going to do?" It reaches the point where, you know, if you're not cheating, you're not trying. I mean, he didn't want to be there. But because, I mean, Apple... The more I looked into the Apple situation, and Greg helped me out with this, well, they only have, like, check this, will you, Greg? They only have 14,000 employees over there, but there's 1.5 million people that service Apple. That would be a 20-year, maybe 15, to bring that whole infrastructure back over here. How long would that take? We're not talking about, you know, manufacturing phones, you know, in the suburbs a year from now. You probably can put them in. You probably could take 5,000 Apple people from over there, bring them over here. You probably could do that, but how do you get the 1.5 million other people over here? The people from Foxconn and those guys that make the screens and everything else that you would say. Apple's more just an assembler, aren't they?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you get that other infrastructure?
I think they're halfway done with that. They've been talking for a while on how they're moving to India.
I think they might be moving some of the assembly. The other 1.5 million,
they're already producing.
They're doing some stuff. I agree with you, Greg. But that infrastructure is, you know, people that have never been involved in a manufacturing stuff think this is all easy. It's not. I mean, you move a plant, what is it, John? I mean, God's sake, 2 or 3 years easy, isn't it? And that's in the country. I mean, I'm just saying the enormity of this. Now, how we should, is there anything we could have done to where Apple never had the 1.5 million? But I mean, who's working in all these 1.5 million factories? I mean, what's the labor situation there like? I mean, I don't know the answer, but is it we're not going to do business with anybody that lets people under 16 work? Are we? I mean, where would you start this, John?
No, that's the thing. We bought so heavily into this, you know, climate, Tom, that we've now become, you know, offenders of things we would never want to happen in this country or to be associated with in any way. But there's a moral vacuum by saying it's you know, we don't have to look at it because it's not happening to people we consider Americans, and you know,
yeah,
and you know, they're benefiting from this, wink wink. And now I think the whole system is likely to have a reckoning like we're not really prepared for, because I don't think you can trust data coming out of China about their population or about their prospects for growth or their appetite for products, you know, made here or anywhere. Their buying power, I think, is severely reduced. And, you know, the tariffs, I think, are going to speed up a kind of, you know, reckoning where we really see how awful a system we enable. So,
well, Kevin just texted in.
We've been paying a price all along for it. We just didn't expect anybody to revolt against it.
I think somehow or another, we always hoped that somehow they would change. And it sure doesn't do anything.
This is the silliest. I mean, I don't believe in abandoning hope ever.
Yeah.
But to bank so heavily on it and have so little evidence that it's going to evolve that way, other than you think it has to be that way, and it shows just how entranced you were by your own beliefs and how stupid the Chinese would be not to be.
It's not exactly going swimmingly for them right now. It's not going that well. And when stresses are applied to their system, and especially if they're in a short time period, like kind of they've been, there's an argument in that it could be working better now than it was when we had the unlimited money printing.
Well, Kevin just texted it that they know, the corporations know exactly what they're getting over there. That they went.
Oh, yeah.
Now, the question is, what do you do about it? And I remember doing this, but I don't want to get into it again, but I'll just briefly, when the COVID first started, and we did a show every day during the COVID, and we were pretty much on this as best we can. The big places, there were people that flew employees back and forth to Wuhan and in Milan. If those can remember, Wuhan is a big area for garments, right, Jan? They do a lot of clothes over there. And it wasn't one of the biggest hotbed of COVID, if people don't remember, was in Milan. Because Milan, you know, what fashion is like a national sport in Milan, right? None of us would walk down the street in Milan like we do now, you know, like sweats and stuff. But the amount of people that flew back and forth from Milan to Wuhan, that was where the COVID outbreak really was in Europe, right? If it came out of Milan. And I wonder how many corporate people knew that there was a big problem in Wuhan and still sent people from here and from Italy and other places to fly over there and do their stuff when they knew there was a problem. And you know what, John, I guess we're never going to go after people like that. But yeah. I guess I got to hope there's a hell, right? I mean, what else can I say? Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, well, you can't tell me that the Priskers didn't know that their Hyatts were experiencing disruptions, you know, to their business.
But I don't know what they sent, you know, if they sent corporate people over in there knowing that the place was there. I mean, somebody here had to know. My one of our buddies, he's been on the show this a couple times, Greg, attorney Greg, said he was in an Uber with a guy from where his parents from Wuhan. And this is when it first started, and the Chinese were talking about 10,000 dead. And the guy says to him, "What are you talking about? My mother and father are still over there. Everybody's dying." He goes, 10,000 dead in China is nothing. He goes, there's got to be a few million people down. And this was 3 months after it started. He goes, they got crematoriums going 24/7. They brought some new ones into the place.
And that's the growth industry, Tom. Yeah.
I think people, corporations here were still flying their people over there. Yeah, I mean, but how do you, I mean, Kevin's right, Carl's right, you're right, but what do you do about it? These people are insulated. Meanwhile, Trump wants to reopen Alcatraz. Maybe we could open up and throw those guys in there. I'd do that, wouldn't you? S&P futures down 46. NASDAQ futures down 206. We'll be right back. I think Audrey's resigned today. We'll be right back. Stocks and Jocks.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. Confused about investing these days? I suspect you are not alone. Investing was never easy, although at times it may have seemed so. I think one reason behind the current concern, although maybe not explained as such, is how the fluctuation in the American dollar and the associated politics is affecting your investments and your wealth. It may not be enough to make some money in your investments. You may need now to make enough to exceed the amount that your leadership is depreciating the value of the dollars you've worked your whole life to accumulate. That same leadership has seen fit to maneuver risk-free interest rates to near zero. Providing positive risk-averse returns in a zero-interest and declining real wealth environment is by far the toughest assignment I've ever had in my years as a money manager. I'm sure that a lot of you have heard that one way to possibly deal with this problem is to invest in so-called hard currencies like silver and gold, the idea being that they will retain their relative value in the face of devaluation of paper currencies like the dollar. To be honest, I have never been a gold bug. I've always had faith that having enough dollars and a good investment strategy was good enough. Now I'm not so sure. But I do know that if I did invest in gold or silver, I'd want to do it in the same manner as we do with PTI for investments in the market, with defined risk. If you feel the need to invest in gold or silver, we can do it using the same strategies that we use for our protected index program. No matter what you invest in, we feel that you need to know and control your risk. Find us at PTISecurities.com. That's PTISecurities.com.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to factor in the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other life decision. Your brain is smarter than your gut, and that's why you owe it to yourself to read Luckbox. We've made it easy because Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with timely, actionable trading ideas, and equips you with savvy investing tactics you don't already know, all while exploring how to live your best life through music, spirits, food, sports, travel, fitness, and a whole lot more. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on controlling their financial futures. It's for overachievers and alpha types who don't buy into Wall Street's investment gurus. It's for mavericks who believe in life, luxury, and the pursuit of happiness. It's for you. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities. They play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
20,000 francs says it isn't.
Is that a serious offer?
I just paid out 20. I'd like to get it back.
Make it 10. I'm only a poor, corrupt official.
Hello, welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm going to say that was a theme song of Crime Story, and it's Del Shannon.
You're right, absolutely.
What a great show that was. Boy, talk about... I actually have I'll have to pick out a few of them. I bought the entire 5 years of Crime Story. And you're going to say, why the hell did you do that? You know how it ended. Why'd I buy it, man?
Because of the theme song?
No, I can't play the theme song. Because... if you want to see what Chicago looked like in those 5 years, it's like a period piece.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
And you'd be just say, well, that was on that corner? It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
S&P futures down 47, NASDAQ futures down 207. Not sure why, but Netflix is down $60. It's 5%. They're one of the biggest movers today. Not sure why that is, but they are down a bunch. I don't think they had earnings on a Monday morning, but Dow futures down 250. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX up 171 still, 0.7%. FTSE up 99, 1.1%. One of their banks went way up. They bought some Polish banks. And Erste Group Bank's up 7%. Gakaran's down 46.6%. So a little bit mixed over there, but mostly up. Asia, now this is weird because nobody's traded. Nikkei traded Friday, or 5-2. Hang Seng traded 5-2 as well. Shanghai hasn't traded since 4:30. That's bizarre world. Friday... Again, it was the last of a big day on the way up. Well, we might still be up today. Dow was up 564, S&P up 82, NASDAQ up 266. So we've had a huge run for like over a week. Bonds this morning, 1 basis point, 4.33. Bund unchanged at 2.51. Oil, this was the big news overnight. It got down to 55.50. Then it was up to 57.50. Now it's down a buck 11 to 57.14. So that's the lowest oil has been in a while. Again, it's up from the low last night, at least so far. Brent down $1, 60.28. Natural gas up 3 cents, 2.66. Arabob down a penny. It's still at $2. Gold up $84 now, which is really good for my guys, because a lot of my people are in some of the gold or the metals. The only problem is I usually have something above the market to kind of double up on the way up. I do not right now. I don't know if I want to sell it here or buy it. We'll have to figure that out during the day. Silver up 35 cents, 32.90. Copper up 4 cents, 4.69. We've got foreign exchange. This is part of the problem. The dollar is slipping with the pound at euro at 113.6, which is kind of a high. British pound 133.3. So again, dollar heading south means gold goes up. This is all together. Crypto, Bitcoin's down $1,200, 94,281. A lot of wordage there, Matt. What do you got for us? Quick traffic, weather, sports, and we'll get to Audrey.
Yeah, definitely. Good morning, everyone. It's currently 7:37 a.m. on May 5th, 2025. Let's look at traffic real quick. Inbound on the Kennedy from O'Hare to Janeburn Interchange is at 32 minutes. Outbound at 46. Inbound on the Dan Ryan from 95th to JB at 29 minutes. Outbound at 12. As far as weather in Chicago, 48 degrees at Midway and 50 at O'Hare. High of around 59 today with fog and a slight chance of showers. High humidity, about 80% right now. Tonight, partly cloudy and a low of 47. Meanwhile, down in Phoenix, Arizona, it's 60 degrees right now. Partly cloudy and a high of 69 degrees. Sports, we got MLB yesterday. Cubs played against the Brewers and lost 4-0. This marks their 14th loss this season compared to their 21 wins. Cubs back at Wrigley Field tonight against the Giants. Game starts at 6:40. White Sox, one against. Astros, 5-4. Sox not faring well this season, though, with only 10 wins this season and 24 losses. Tonight they're in Kansas against the Royals, 6:40 p.m. We saw Pacers in the NBA yesterday take down the Cavaliers, 121-112. And the Warriors defeated Rockets, final score 103-89. Tonight we see the Knicks at Celtics, 6 p.m., and Nuggets at Thunder, 8:30 p.m. That's all I got, Chief. Back to you.
John, how would you like to be the Astros to come up here and play 3 games in a park with nobody in it, and then on one night it rains, and then you come out of here losing 2 out of 3 with the crummiest team in baseball.
Yeah. What was the paid attendance last night, Tom? I don't think there were 30 people.
You know what? Matt'll look that up, but it'll show you what their season ticket load is. Actually, Sunday's probably one of those package days, too, though.
Yeah.
Do we have Audrey?
Yeah.
We do indeed.
Hey, Aud.
It's me.
It's Nance.
Yeah, it is.
Oh, because we had, I thought it was going to be Aud. And we had 3 people already calling in from the Goose Rescue, and they want to give her a medal.
Did she rescue a goose?
3 little gooselings. They couldn't get up the curb on 95th Street with traffic all stopped. So I threw a coat around them and saved the little ones. And we're hoping that the Oaklawn police want to drop down one of the storm drains, and they were going down there to rescue that one. They were really being nice about it. And I hope that if they got their 4 kids together, somehow Ma and Pa Goose made it back to wherever the hell they came from. But they were not happy with Audrey touching the little ones.
Well, did she just hop out of the car?
You know her. A couple of guys were stopped, so nobody was going to run them over. And they were trying to, you know, urge him up onto the curb. So Audrey, being an animal lover forever, you got to use a coat. So she takes her nice coat. We were just at a First Communion. Goes out there, gathers up the little gooselings. As the Ma and Pa Goose are trying to nip her in the butt, she manages to dodge that, thankfully, because they were not happy hissing at her. And she grabbed the little ones and kicked them on the other side of the fence so they couldn't get back, back on the street. And the mother and father were waiting for the police to give them number 4. And I hope they got back to wherever the hell they were supposed to. The little ones couldn't fly. Wherever they got there, they walked. I saw 95th Street, the thing is jammed. That's your girl. She was terrific.
Well, that is good news.
Yeah, she was terrific.
Well, well, well.
Now, if there's a goose...
What can we say to that? I haven't rescued anybody.
I haven't rescued anything lately. I mean, whatever. Anyway, so that's where that all is. What's going on in your world? Steady as she goes. We're talking about China stuff and the debt they, well, we're going to talk a little about the debt they have on their real estate, and somehow or another, they're keeping it afloat. But let's talk more about what you're up to. The said you're starting to get some, some
there's activity out there, and that's good. I mean, we are seeing more and more loans coming in, but you know, it's not what it was when the rates were in the twos and threes. That's for sure. But it's steady as she goes.
But you've given us examples the last few weeks of good news where people maybe got divorced or something and ended up, one of them didn't have a high credit rating and had to get a crummy mortgage. Now their credit rating's better and you're getting them a better mortgage. That's like the good news part. You also said some people, because their credit card stuff is so high, what was the number last month, John? That only 11% of the people 11% of the people paid the minimum. That's a record or something. You said some people now are saying they can't do it anymore on the credit cards and they're actually paying higher on the mortgage to get a lower blended rate. Is that still happening, Nance?
Yeah, that's always going to, that is happening. I mean, people are, I've waited a long time for this to pass and it hasn't really, you know, the rates of 3%, I think we will not see those anymore in our lifetime. So you're going to have to make up your mind what's worse, paying rates or.
What's the history on that? I think when my parents bought the bungalow in 102nd Place, which by the way I drove by after the first communion, I think they paid 6% or 5.8% or something. For years and years, I think the savings and loan, they paid out what, 3.25% on a passbook. The mortgages were 6%, so the spread was like 2.75%. It paid for the building, the people, the Little League jerseys, and you know that wasn't much of a spread. That was actually pretty efficient, I think. I think it's
mortgages were 20 years; they weren't 30 years.
Mortgages were 20 years.
I thought they might. I think my parents got a 30.
I found my parents' original documents, and that was 1966, maybe 67.
This would have been 58, so right in there.
Yeah, and it was 5.25%, and it was for 30 years.
What was the savings and loan? Do you remember?
Mine were it was Oakland Trust and Savings Bank.
Oh, really? Okay. So they were Oakland Bank, not the savings and loan.
No, it was the bank, not the savings and loan. Wow. I believe, yeah. I mean, that's what it said on the top. It's interesting because that was pretty, I mean, when you think about that, there was a high rate probably back then for the amount of money they made. So, because that's really what now they're in the sixes. I mean, that's not really that bad. If you were only 2 or 3% over the passbook savings, that was really actually, I think, a decent deal.
Well, that's what I'm saying. But the spread, I'm always looking at, you know, this kind of stuff. It's my economic mind that causes a problem. I'm going to say the spread was 2.75%, 2.875%. Which I think is efficient as all get out. What is it now between how much you make? What do you make at a bank and a savings account? 1.5%, and your mortgage is 7%. Well, that's what.
They're not using that theory anymore. Now it all is based off the 10-year bond.
Well, whatever the theory is, the spread is now 5.5%, right?
Well, okay.
I don't care what page you put the theory on. It sucks compared to, I'm saying the savings and loans were a lot more efficient than people give them credit for. Because the people who ran the savings and loans, I don't think the president of Concordia made $1 million a year, do you, Jen?
Oh, no.
Oh, God, no. I agree with you, no.
Plus, they didn't even have to do a formal appraisal. They knew the person lived next door to the house that was getting the loan out. They knew the neighborhood. They knew the business climate. They knew your credit. They knew you personally in many cases because you've done business with them for generations, maybe. And This got rid of the possibility that you have a loan being processed in a place nobody ever heard of, thousands of miles away, but they don't know what this thing is and couldn't care less. So, you know, it was very, very different. A lot of safety built into it.
John, do you know if they made them have 20% down at that point or more than that or what? Do you know? One's getting away with 3 or 5, right?
No. As I recall, I mean, Chesterfield Federal was my parents' savings and loan, and I think, you know, the last house they bought through them, I think they put 20% down. It was a 6% mortgage for 20 years. This was in 1966. They had a mortgage with, I think, 20% down in 56, too. 60%, 20 years. I mean, this was just the way Chesterfield did it. And, you know, they were honest and they, you know, were careful. They didn't just throw money at houses they had no business lending money on. And they were trusted by their depositors. And, you know, the system was, it worked like a timepiece. It was very, you know, easily monitored. They had no foreclosures in their portfolio. I mean, it was really, you know, much better system.
I think my parents put 20% down, but the bungalow was 18.9, brand new. It wasn't, you know, it was kind of a nice, didn't have a garage or anything, but it was new. It was okay. It had a bath and a half, which most of them didn't. So it was okay. I think they ponied up to $3,600.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there wasn't really hardly any risk. I mean, you know, if they'd have bagged out, you surely could have sold it for $14,500, right?
Yeah. I think my parents, you know, they both worked the first year they were married and bankrolled my mother's salary. And that was their down payment for their first house. And she had, I think, like $2,000. And so and they paid $12,500 for their first house. So they had a nice down payment.
But it was a time when you talk about, you know, I mean, you didn't want to be alive back then. God help you if you had a disease, right? And if you had a bad tooth, they just pulled it out. So health wise, you really wanted to have good genes in the 50s and 60s, right, Nance? I mean, but the economically, I mean, my stepfather was he was an accounting degree at DePaul and a GI Bill, so he did okay. But every year, I'm going to say this was 59, 58. By 1964, just with, I'm going to say the inflation rate was probably 2, and the average person was, there were any kind of promotion or whatever, you probably got what, 3-4% a year increase, Jen, in your pay.
Yeah, yeah.
It was just a time like that, unlike now. That's why, and I can't emphasize enough how much different this is to people's economic well-being. I'm going to say by 1964, the mortgage was half of one paycheck. You know, because he probably went from making, you know, $8,000 a year to 22 or something like that, and meanwhile the mortgage, what's the mortgage on $15,000 mortgage, Nance? It can't be very much. It's 6%, right?
Not at 30 years, no.
Yeah, I mean,
cars back then were only about $3,000, weren't they? $2,800.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And there was no other consumer debt at that time either. I mean, you had a mortgage and maybe a car loan. There weren't student loans. You know, you didn't have, you know, MasterCard or anything else. It was a pretty tight ship people ran.
Well, you remember Hilltop Realty? Well, that's where Audrey's first license was. But he was a big shot. Oh, what the hell was the guy's name? He was a big shot at Notre Dame Club of Chicago, and he did all the interviewing for the kids for scholarships. He and a buddy of ours, Craig Fowler, they were the two guys that were Edwards Audrey, the name. But my mother and father, my dad before he died in 56, moved out of the family home and left it to my aunt, bought a place at 56th and Bishop for like next to nothing. This had to be 1954, 55, and right before he died. But the mortgage was at Hilltop Realty over on Ashland. And one day a week, my aunt, who was living with us because my dad was dead, it's going to be 1958, we would go over there. My brother was in the stroller, now the president was a PTI. And the mortgage was $12. That was our mortgage, and he'd give me a buck back because he liked my mother. He goes, "Here, Tom, here's a buck." I remember that. So the mortgage was $12, and he gave me a buck back. And I give my brother a sucker. My aunt was always so pissed off why he didn't give her him a buck too. My mother's like, "He's already given you 10% of the mortgage back. What are you complaining about?" But anyway, then he moved. Then they moved somewhere else. They were around forever. Not Hilltop. It was.
I remember I found the passbook for my parents' second mortgage, or the second house they bought, and the payments were $86 a month, and that included taxes too. So that was a tax escrow as well.
But this wasn't Hilltop. It was some. I forget. I don't remember the guy's name. Audrey. Obviously, she got her first light. But the thing I'm concerned about right now, the spread is wide between savings and mortgage, and it's too wide. I think.
Well, that's all the loans are backed by the government. So, I mean, and they weren't really up to them.
Yeah, but they weren't back then. But somebody who has savings now is falling further behind than they ought to. Plus, the guys from Fannie Mae, I don't see them buying Little League uniforms, do you?
No, absolutely not. But in Europe, they don't even have 30-year mortgages. They only have 5, 3, 5, and 7. That's it.
But they're not amortized. There's a balloon, right? They can't expect
they're
you to pay
both.
It all.
They're both. Tom. Okay. They're both.
Because they can't they're expect both. You to pay the thing off in 7 years, do they?
But then they have to. You have to remortgage it.
Right.
Yeah.
And you have to qualify to remortgage it, and that's kind of where it could get sticky. I see.
Yeah.
Are you doing any flexibles now? Are they around? Are
no,
they back?
The flexible since they took away the LIBOR and they've gone to this new one, it's not anywhere near what the rates that they used to be. So no.
If somebody wanted a flex, what would they be paying now?
Probably the same as the. There's very little difference between that and the fixed, so you might as well just go with the fixed.
Okay.
There's no introductory rates. There's nothing that would entice you to do that.
Because there were a few guys on the trading floor, I'm going to say 20 years ago, got the flexible rates, and they made out like a bandit. All he did was go down for like 15 years.
Yeah, I'd like to back this up to, John, did you say that only 11% of the minimum credit card payments were made?
I said that, but I asked John. Yeah, 11% of credit cards last month had a minimum payment. That's
so
a lot.
So 89% didn't pay?
What?
89%
no,
didn't
no, everybody
pay?
No, they paid more than the minimum.
Oh, they paid more than the minimum.
Yeah, but 11% is like a high for people only paying the minimum.
Really?
Yeah. I think that indicates that they're maxed out.
Yeah.
So those are huge. They're carrying huge balances every month.
I know the credit card debt I see now is very high.
Oh, it's
very
huge. High. Yeah. I think we're records, but I'm not. You know, I was record this month or whatever. I think we're. It's how does somebody? I mean, if you got, I would never think. I mean, I guess I'm not. If I had 2 or 3 credit cards and something bad happened, and most of mine are 15, 20 grand, I tried to get one lower and I wouldn't do it. If I maxed out on 3 of them, how the hell do I get the 4th? Why would somebody give me the 4th?
Tom, I have no idea. The average credit card debt I see now, when I first started, the average credit card debt I saw was around less than 10, maybe. And now I see at least 25 to 40 as the average.
How do you get the 40 without somebody cutting you off?
I really don't know. To me, it's amazing. And they're teaching the kids in college in high school to not get into credit card debt and don't get credit cards when you go to college, etc. And some parents are saying, isn't that bad? And I said, it's there's good and bad. I mean, they're trying to keep the kids from running them up, which I understand, but you also have to have credit when you get out because you have to buy a car and you have to, maybe you don't have to buy a car, I don't know, but I'm saying without credit, you can't do anything. So how do you get them credit, right? So they'll give it to them when they're in college, but they won't give it to them when they get out. So you do have to show that you're responsible. So it has to kind of be watched. And the parents are saying, do you think this is right? They don't feel it's right. But they're teaching the kids in school not to have any, and I understand why, because it's far worse to have too much than it is to have none. Really, both are bad, but of the two, too much is the worst.
Well, when I was a senior, there were
in high school or college?
College, they sent me a thing that everybody who graduated from good schools was a good credit risk. It was Union Oil. They sent me a credit card if I wanted it. I think my line of credit was maybe $300. Wasn't even enough for a set of tires, but it got conked on the road.
Well, was Union Oil for a gas station?
Yeah,
it was
just a credit station, just a gas station card. No, they didn't. Visa, a lot of people, they didn't exist.
They didn't exist. Okay, so then could you buy tires in a gas station?
Oh yeah. Gas stations. Most gas stations, they were also service facilities, right, Jen?
Yeah. They cart repairs, you buy chewing gum.
You went and got your oil change and everything else at the same gas station. They all had a couple of bays. in those days. But credit card debt now is $1.3 trillion. Per holder, $8,200 per holder. Wow, Nance, I would not have guessed it was that high, would you?
No. No, I mean, I see it every day. I see it every day, and it is high. The biggest thing that's blowing me away now is the car average car payment is probably $800, $823.
Something like that, yeah.
The average? Oh, my God.
Yeah. I see it all day long.
What's the length then? 7 years now? 7 or 10?
72 months, 6 years, 7 years, 8 years. They've got them up there, but to me, $823 a month is a huge payment for 7 years.
Well, one thing you kind of don't want to do is have your car loan be further out than the warranty.
Yep.
Well, that's a kiss of death.
Well, could be. That's at 7 years, I'm sure. I mean, GM only has 3 years, 36,000 miles, right?
Still, I think they're further. Well, who's the guys with the, is it Kia? That's the, how many years, 100,000 miles, Jen? Or there's a couple of companies that are pretty far.
Yeah, I think it's Kia.
Hyundai and Kia have 100,000 miles, 10 years or 100,000 miles on the powertrain. And then I think the warranty is 5 years, 60,000 miles. And the whole car in itself, and you don't have to buy anything extra. I mean, 5 years is pretty good.
Yeah.
But I don't know what to say about this. I just think $823 with a house payment of, and the average house payment now is what, all in is around $3,000. So I mean, you're talking $4,000 without even.
Yeah,
that's anything big else. Up. I mean, to me, that just seems high.
Well, my significant other and the goose lady, Audrey, had this discussion in 2007. I mean, of course, Audrey's in real estate, and has kind of a different view than I do. And by the way, she's been mostly right and me wrong, but in terms of housing prices. So, but I still have it here somewhere. I mean, if I was cleaning up the place, I saw it and lost it again. There was an article regarding, this is 2007, before the big crasheroo. But the house value at the time was 235 or something, right, Nance? I'm going to say 2007, 2008. So if somebody gave you, you know, when people used to be able to give you the down payment, if somebody gave you the 20% down payment, so now you're down to 46, so say your mortgage is 190, you needed $85,000 to get that mortgage and the average taxes and insurance and stuff that went with it, $85,000. The article went through who made $85,000 in 2007. And the answer is not very many people, like 15% of the people. If you were in the restaurant industry, you made maybe 20, unless you own the place, or were a bartender or waitress in a place with nice tips. If you were in a regular schmo who worked in a cubicle downtown, you were at the 40, 45 range. This is 17 years ago, so... And if you worked in a hospital with a good job, but not a doctor, you were around 60 to 62. So those are all, you know, I won't say the restaurant stuff, but they're all pretty good jobs. You know, you're going to work every day, you're doing your thing. You were somewhere half to two-thirds of what you needed for the mortgage in 2007. So my point at the time was, somehow or another, this dog doesn't hunt. There's going to have to be a coming of the ages here or whatever, a come to Jesus moment. And there was, you know, I didn't like to see it or whatever, but somewhere along the line. Well, now I think with the housing prices at 410 and the, I'm going to say the average wage is up to like 45, I think the average person, now most people have two incomes in the house, but for the average person, you're way further away from affording that house than you were in 2007. So the question is, how do we not have the same outcome? Is there a way we don't have the same outcome? You guys are the experts. Part of it is two people in the family working, right, Nance?
Well, that's correct. I mean,
and you were the one that told the show that a lot of people you talk to now is really two and a half people working. Somebody's doing income taxes on Saturdays or whatever. You almost have two and a half workers per family. Well, that's about as far as that can go, unless you got the 14-year-old caddying and taking his money or something, right?
Yeah, but and that is true. That is what's happening. I just, you know, how you're saying how long can it last? I guess it's going to last until somebody, you know, there's some kind of tragedy. let's face it. I mean, if somebody gets really sick and you lose an income, that's going to be somewhat of a problem.
Well, if you look at the housing price, we just did this on, was it Leran last week, Jan? I went through the CPI from 2000, okay, and we're up. They claim they're up 80%, right? All right, so a new home in 2000 was 164, according to this U.S. debt clock. So let's say 80% more than that would be, times 8, we'd be at like 280, right?
Yeah.
And we're at 415.
Huh?
Yeah, in the real price. So according to the CPI, it should be 280, and it's 415. Now, median income in 2000 was 32, and now it's 44. So that's up by 30%. Our houses are up by 140%. So we're way worse, aren't we, in terms of income versus house?
It can't end well. Maybe it's already ended.
I mean, are we the only three people on Earth that are doing this math?
People are inspired. They feel they can afford it, and it's all about cash flow. That's all they look at.
Well, it's also
cash flow.
What do you see? I mean, you're more with, well, I got my clients, but you know, my clients are different because they have assets, they've got stock and things. The American dream in 1957, 58, 60. Not saying I was alive then. I'm only 35. The next year is always going to be better than this year. That was
right.
That was America.
That was big.
And now, but now, do you see that? Some of the people one of the guys, Roy, works at the SIBO. He has a drink with us once in a while. He actually lives out of town and comes back, but he works out a different place. Anyway, he brings a lot of these younger dudes in that work in compliance and things like that. And I'd like to see you guys down here maybe some Thursday night when they're around, just to talk to them. They don't see anything like that. I'm still going to have this job next year. I didn't get a raise last year. I'm not going to get one next year. I work in compliance. I'm going nowhere. I'm never going to afford a house. I probably won't even ever get married. It's a whole... I don't even recognize that among young people in America. I mean, we always thought the world was our oyster, even if we were screwed up, right?
Yeah.
That's true. I mean, that is true. I don't see, I agree with the fact that people are not seeing it, but the people... A lot of people work for themselves and they think it's great and they have this lifestyle balance and they feel that we did not have that. That all we did was ever work. So,
well, I mean, these guys they'll say, I'm in the industry. You guys used to have fun. There used to be an opportunity where you could be a trader. You could actually make money because we're never going to be a trader. We're never going to learn how to trade. Well, we were working in some back office somewhere, you know, counting what other people do. I mean, their view of coming to work in the morning is so much different than mine was. And I was always going to do okay. I was going to do this. I mean, it was going to be a good day trading, no matter how many bad days in a row. I always thought the next day was going to be a good one. And you know, I couldn't wait to hire somebody if we had the dough to do it. I mean, they look at me like I'm some guy from Mars. You know, I even still feel that way. Tomorrow's going to be a better day for my clients in PTI. But they don't. How can you feel like that when you're 25 or 30? Well, they can be like when they're our age, Nance. I mean, good Lord.
I have no idea. I'm concerned about the people in the future coming up that are just on this monthly thing. How are they going to make it when they get to Social Security and they find out they can't live on it?
I don't know about that.
You know, and there's no pensions anymore or anything like that. You just have your 401ks, which go up and down like,
yeah,
you know, tomorrow. Well, and so people like you aren't even around anymore.
Well, no, we won't be 100 years from now. I got news for us, but unless somebody comes up with some nice new drug and says you guys are really supposed to live to 200. You've got mortgage rates are where?
They're in the sixes and the sevens, depending on, you know, what your circumstances are. So, last week I had someone who said that he files his tax returns, you know, every 7 years.
Every 7 years?
Yeah, it's what he does. He just does them all at once, 7 years at a time.
Well, I hope that they owe him and not the other way around.
I said, well, do you have to... I was just shocked. I said, really? I said, what does the IRS have to say about that? And he said, nothing.
Well, if you owe them, they don't care. They'll say you're an idiot, but they won't care.
They just said, he said that there's penalties and there's interest and all of that, and he doesn't file, and that's the way he does things. So he can't give me his tax returns. So he was upset when I said, well, guess what? You're not going to get a mortgage. You're not going to qualify. We're shocked.
Well, if you were just starting out and you were 17 and every year the government owed you a couple $100 and you didn't file till you were 25, and so you filed the last 8 years and they owed you every single year, the IRS doesn't care. But I think if you owe them, I think they care.
Well, he owes them.
I'm not a tax guy, but what do you think, Jack? I mean, I'm sure they'll make you a deal and you pay the interest and pay the penalty.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm sure, but they do care.
Yeah, but why would they let them do it again?
Why would you want to if you got to pay penalties, for God's sake?
Just says it didn't bother them.
God, where do you find these people? That
I mean, you know, he's upset at me that he can't get a mortgage, and he had to buy this weekend. He's moving to Chicago. He had to buy this weekend, and it took me all day Thursday to get everything ready, and then when I called him and said, okay, here's what I'm going to need, and he was like, well, I don't do that. I was just shocked. I was just in shock, and he's like, well, what are you saying? And I said, you're not going to be able to get a mortgage.
Was he in his sixth year not paying, or his first year? If it's the first year, he could just actually do the year.
He's in his fourth year of not paying.
So he's got to do four taxes to get...
Yeah, 4 years taxes. He's not going to do it because he only does them every 7 years.
Even if it means he can't get a mortgage. He can't break the system and do it after 4 years. God.
No, and then the next day he started again, and finally on Friday I got through to him that, look, I don't make up these rules. I mean, I have programs, you know, off of Wall Street where I can do other things, but I said you don't qualify because your credit score is in the toilet.
Well, if he's looking for a brokerage firm or an investment advisor, please don't give him my name.
I mean, I was just disheartened. I was shocked. I was like, I have, and you don't want to say you wasted your time, but
you wasted your time.
Unfortunately, that is how I felt at the end. And I said, then do me a favor. I said, just file your last 2 years of tax returns. One of the questions on the app is, are you in owe any federal debt? That goes directly to the tax returns. And
so,
he goes,
so
oh.
What do you put
he said,
down?
Oh, is that what that meant? And I'm like, yes.
So what does he? What do you put down? Yes, but I'm not sure because I haven't filed.
No.
What does
no,
that look like?
He said it doesn't matter to him. He said his tax return should have absolutely nothing to do with this process.
Well, that's interesting.
It was educational. It was frustrating. It was very difficult to find a way to get through them. In the end, I finally got through to him, and I said, just do your last 2 years of tax returns first. That's the first thing you can do that to get yourself.
Yeah, you can't do that if you don't know the carryovers and stuff.
I don't even know where to be. I said you can be in a payment plan to the IRS and still get a mortgage, but you can't ask a federal institution with your credit score. It shows you don't know how to repay.
Well, Nance, we got a dash, but do us a favor. Don't recommend John as an attorney or me as a money manager. Keep this guy to yourself.
Thank you, Tom.
just saying. By the way, how's the puppy? Is he calmed down at all? I haven't seen him in a while.
The puppy?
Your dog.
Yes, I know the puppy. I know him. I was thinking of giving him to you as a gift.
Oh, God. Nance went out and decided she needed another dog, and she got a little guy that's a little too much energy.
He's a lot of energy. He's a handful. So, let me tell you.
You gotta love him, Nance. You gotta love him.
Everybody that comes in said, he's so cute. And then they watch him he just runs and runs and runs and runs and runs.
Oh,
and my neighbors came out Friday, Saturday, and they wanted to meet him. So I handed him over the fence, and they have a little Shih Tzu who is like an older dog, you know, old man. And they got along so good. And then they wanted to give him back, and they couldn't catch him. And they said, oh, my God, is he fast? And I said, yes, I know. This is his number one problem.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks. And two kids running around after a dog that they couldn't catch in a fenced backyard.
God. Thanks, guys. Thanks, Matt. SP Futures down 43. NASDAQ Futures down 195. We'll see if we come back from this. We have been. Today it's a little further down. This oil news is a little bit troubling if you get any oil stocks. That the XLE is down $1.12. It's almost 1.5% down to 80. It was up over 90. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now.
I'm shocked to find that gambling is going on in here.
You're winning, sir.
Oh, thank you very much.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to ptisecurities.com. PTI Pro Direct. Trade for as low as a penny per share and a dollar per option contract. Learn more at ptiprodirect.com. Nadex, offering an intuitive way to trade the financial markets. Visit nadex.com. HomeSource Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. Hamzy Analytics. Listen to Fari Hamzy every other Thursday and visit HamzyAnalytics.com. ChiroMed. Back or neck pain? Schedule a complimentary consultation by calling 708-403-2727. Dax Research. Tune in for David Andelman's technical analysis on Mondays and Thursdays and call 1-800-821-4968.